Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
So let's take a look at those business and some other stories that are making the papers this morning. Delighted to be joined by Caroline Reedy of the HR Suite. Welcome, Caroline. And Stephen O'Leary, the founder of Alitico. You're both very welcome. A lovely morning out there, and thanks for coming in.
A pleasure.
Stephen, I might start with you. Mary Hanafin seems to be making a self-declared run for the Oras. I'm not sure how much in the loop Micheál Martin is on this, but she wants to run for the Oras on the Fianna Fáil ticket.
Yeah, this is Conor Feehan and Mary Regan writing today about this, I suppose, kind of relative breaking story. I mean, there was always going to be someone who'd go first, right? And she's very much first out of the traps here. So the story is interesting. You're right. I don't know how much Micheál Martin knows about this either, or certainly maybe how much has been discussed. But the line, there's a couple of lines that stood out for me in this story. One is the idea that Fianna Fáil have to run one. Right. So she makes the point that it would be an insult if the party doesn't. But the other is the cost of the campaign. So it's estimated that the cost of running a candidate or contesting the election is well above €500,000.
And you can imagine it would be.
You could. But on the flip side, it is a significant amount of money to have to raise. And you think about the barriers that puts in place maybe for other candidates. Right. So you almost have to have the power of a party behind you if you're going to do this. Although what's really interesting is to maybe contrast this with the New York mayoral elections that happened this week too, where you had kind of like the billionaire candidate who had raised lots and lots of money losing out to the grassroots person. And that point is made here too by Hannah, but she talks about the importance of this being not purely a media run campaign, but one that happens locally. And that's the argument, that they have to pick someone soon so that the candidate can go around the country, meet the public and talk to them ahead of the actual election.
And Caroline, we're told in that said article that Fianna Fáil hasn't contested a presidential election so far this century. That makes it sound very, as if it's like 100 years since they put it in, but it's only like 25.
It is, yeah. I suppose, obviously, in the last one, they didn't contest Michael D. Higgins, who obviously was a very popular choice, and I think still is. But it's going to be really interesting now. The people who have put their name forward, it looks like, is going to be Mairead McGuinness as a definite. Sean Kelly is going making up his mind, but is looking very likely, it would seem, based on the commentary this week. And interestingly, Mary Hanafin said that if Micheál Martin himself, if he wasn't Taoiseach at the minute, she believed would have been a shoo-in. So
that's just trying to be nice to him.
I think she's doing a bit of plamas there in the hope that he might put her on the ticket. But it's very clear that no decision has been made yet. But I think over the next few weeks, we're going to hear about them. There's also talk of Cynthia Nimurucu and Bertie Ahern, who might be interested in the campaign. But I think it's an important constitutional role. And I think we've always selected very strong candidates, you know, over the years for the right time. So hopefully we'll do the same again.
Yeah, let's see. Okay, well, more to come on that because there's not much other news around. But Trump is, and the cost of your filling your car is making the news in the Irish Examiner today. Donald Trump, as he so often does, opted for all capital letters for his post on Truth Social earlier this week. Everyone, keep oil prices down. There you go, Stephen O'Leary.
Yeah, and oil prices have stayed down, but I don't think Trump necessarily is the reason for it, although I'm sure any of the positive news will be claimed by him in relation to this. This is a really interesting piece, and obviously it has that interesting mix of both global and local and some things that we have no control over, such as geopolitical events, certainly in the Middle East, but then things we maybe do have a greater degree of control over, which is essentially how we tax the fuel in Ireland. And that's the two key things that come through in this for me. So there's two contributors to this story in the Examiner. You've got Conor Faulkner and Kevin McPartland from Fuels for Ireland. And essentially what we're kind of seeing coming through here is at a geopolitical level, the focus here seems to be on the Strait of Hormuz. And this is something, I suppose, that maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago we weren't hearing much about at all.
Well, something like, what is it, 80% of the world's fuel goes through there.
Yeah, so its strategic importance isn't open to question. Now, at the moment, again, there seems to be a ceasefire that is holding and the Straits of Hormuz doesn't seem to be kind of under a direct threat. But that worry kind of looms. But I think another thing that's at play here is the speed with which the news cycle is changing at the moment and the speed with which we're seeing things happen means that the markets seem to be just taking a pause and saying, well, look, there's no point having a knee-jerk reaction here to something that maybe happened 12 hours ago, because 12 hours later, the story might have flipped on its head.
Yeah.
And certainly, I think if we look at events over the last 2 weeks, that has come through.
Yeah, interesting. No, it was 20% of the world's fuel passes through the area, yeah. About a fifth of the world's total production, which is significant in itself.
It is.
What was your take on this piece, Caroline? Did you, like, I think Trump is desperately trying to keep prices at home down low, like in terms of consumer prices, but yet he's doing everything in his power to do exactly the opposite.
Yeah, I think
this is the bit I don't really get.
Absolutely. I think what's remarkable is that nothing significant happened, I suppose, post the Israeli attacks on Iran last week. So ultimately, even though nobody knows how fast those tensions could increase, and I suppose Iran has threatened that Strait of Hormuz previously, but ultimately, I suppose, it's the geopolitical piece and it's also the government taxes. 55 to 60% of the money we pay directly goes to the government on taxes, which means that the oil component is actually surprisingly small, as Conor Farquhar, a friend of this show, has outlined. So I suppose ultimately the price is stable at the moment, but that could change at any time. But I think at the moment it's very much welcomed that hopefully it stays like that. And Trump is obviously taking as much credit as he can for that, even though not necessarily playing out to be the way.
And I think this is where the government have an issue in that, as more vehicles go to electric, that fall in revenue from oil is significant. And any tax that's currently on EVs and the like doesn't come anywhere close to making up the shortfall.
It is, but I mean, you know, so often we talk about controlling the controllables, right? You know, we talk about the things like what are the major political things we have no control over, right? And so, for example, you know, when it comes to negotiations on tariffs with the European Union, we've got a voice, but it's obviously not the loudest. We see the same in terms of the geopolitical tensions that are happening in the Middle East. But there are some things we can control, and tax and excise are two of those things.
Yeah.
And that point that Caroline called out around the 55 to 60% in terms of tax, like the government does have control over that. So reviewing that is well within their control.
Yeah, but they won't be doing that anytime soon, Stephen, as we both know. Caroline, Cliff Taylor's piece is a nice follow-on from that, because Europe wants to keep the Donald happy. Quite interesting what he's saying here, that, you know, before Trump was elected, you know, 10% tariff would have been seen as something that just wasn't possible.
Absolutely.
Now we're all kind of saying, well, it could have been way worse. Will we just ride with 10%?
Absolutely. And it's likely those 10% tariffs are going to be accepted, because ultimately, I suppose, the bargaining power the EU has, we can very much see isn't what, you know, versus a Trump. There's a deadline of July 9th in place. And I suppose the biggest challenge here is, will the full EU back do with the one deal, and can they stick together? Obviously, Germany, we've seen that economy really being hit, and particularly their car business. But now that's getting an extra 25% tariffs, as outlined here. And ultimately, I suppose that potentially cause a concern. For Ireland, we're anxious, I suppose, to do a deal, because ultimately, even though the 10% is going to be on the food and drink, I think that's accepted now, that most companies are, you know, incorporating that into the cost. But we don't know yet what's going to happen with the pharma and the tech sector. And obviously, less profit reported here means less corporation tax. So there's a big Irish interest in a deal being done. And I definitely think you're right, Bobby, that the 10%, even though we thought it was sounded crazy prior to this, now is going to be seen as a good deal if we can get the full deal to be done over the line. But I think it's clear to see with Canada this week and others that if we don't do a deal, it's going to be, you know, a big international issue.
Yeah. Are we looking at the art of the deal here, Stephen, in terms of throw the kitchen sink at it and end up back where you wanted to be at the start with 10%?
Yeah, depressingly, we possibly are.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, you know, I suppose it's classic negotiation, right? Everyone wants to come out of this with a win. But we also know the importance of like confidence and stability, especially amongst consumers, right? So consumers are probably looking at this, wondering how much are things going to cost for me in 3 months' time, 6 months' time. And if that's getting people to stall on maybe purchasing decisions, then you start to see the knock-on effect. So it's in everyone's interests to find a deal here, but you're absolutely right. Like, pharma and tech are the big two for us. They're the ones that need to be protected here.
Yeah, and I suppose every country is probably likely to, you know, it might be hard to unite, to look at this from a European level, because, you know, we don't produce cars. Mm. Germany does.
Yep.
You know, we produce pharma. So we're all probably interested in different things to some degree.
We are. And I mean, this is where essentially the European Union kind of needs to stick together and find a deal. Like, the point is made by Taylor in this article that, you know, while the European Union is now looking at expanding into other markets and growing relationships, those are multi-year plans. That's not going to happen by July 9th. So in the short term, a deal has to be done.
And if he ends up fighting with the Canadians, that could actually suit us as well. Because, you know, he may not want to fight a trade war on so many fronts. So let's see what happens. But
yeah,
it is,
hopefully he'll pick his battles. Yeah.
It is an interesting space. Caroline, the first-time buyers in Dublin are now locked out by Help to Buy schemes, warned Savills. And there's a further piece in Cancelling about it being this time of year and people putting out pre sort of budget messages. What are Savills actually telling us here?
Yeah, so as you said, it's the time of year for the pre-budget submissions, and probably this year more than other years, you know, there's a very consciousness of the spending won't be as generous maybe. So people are getting in early, and Savills being one. And ultimately, I suppose what they're saying is that there's a few things, and it's a very good submission by Savills, obviously, who have a self-interest in this. But they're talking about the Help to Buy scheme, and they're basically saying that that should be increased in line with inflation, where at the moment the upper limit is 500,000, and they're basically saying it should go up to at least 621 to reflect inflation. However, I suppose, you know, it's really hard to get an average where you might have a couple of really expensive properties, and, you know, that could skew the average. So I think, you know, the reliability of that, I think, is something that Cantlin has flagged as well, saying that primarily the Dublin region, you know, is where that is primarily being impacted. They're also, you know, talking about the commercial stamp duty to try and ignite the commercial property sector. They also touch on the water supply, and what I think is really understated in general and really needs to get more focus is the construction labour shortage. You know, there's only 62,000 less construction workers. You know, it's a very significant number, a reduction of around 26%. So they're basically saying that we need to do more on construction skills pathways, including apprenticeships that are done within 4 years. And definitely, I think that's one that no matter how, what about anything else, if we don't have the people, and we know we don't have the labour at the moment, it's a really significant issue that we could do something about potentially. And finally, they're talking about the market data to help make more decisions. So you can appreciate why Savills are saying this. Obviously, there's an interest for them to be doing it. The big thing really is this going to be the priority when the Help to Buy scheme was set up to try and get developers to make the numbers stack up on building starter homes? That obviously isn't happening as supply constraints are in place. So the first time buyers, you know, are not getting what the whole scheme was set out.
Right. Well, the big sort of news out of this story for me is the price of a house for a first time buyer. Like, it's basically unaffordable for most of them, given the increase of 24% odd around houses. Like, how can any, you know, young couple afford 621 grand?
Yeah, it's
or anywhere close to it.
Yeah, the prices that are quoted here, you know, are incredible. Like, Cantlin does give that counter to this, where he talks about the dangers of looking at an average when it comes to this, right? That they're notoriously prone to manipulation by singular expensive property sales. So it will be interesting to see whether Cantlin has got a counterpoint here in terms of the prices he puts forward. And he calls out Dunleary Rathdown is kind of one of the key areas. And that a more reliable median data for the same CSO notes that prices exceed 460,000 only in that local authority area.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt because we government have done nothing but talk about it, that housing is going to be the number one issue in the budget when it comes to it. So this is probably the first of multiple pre-budget submissions
yeah.
that housing is going to be the top topic. And, you know, they have this task force. We know that they met with the cabinet within the last couple of weeks. Action has to happen this summer on this. It'll be, you know, while we want to see changes within the budget, we're going to need to see changes before then too.
Caroline, there's a new EU law on antiques and art, pushing more red tape on industry. Some industry bodies, antique dealers, etc., seem a bit concerned about this. This is around the movement of antiques within the EU, essentially, isn't it?
It is indeed. So this, as we know, our EU legislation, generally it takes about a number of years for it to be transposed into Irish law. No different with this. This came about in 2019 and it had a 6-year lead time. So we've known about it for a very long time. And there is a new EU portal being set up and people will have to digitally put up any information to basically show that anything that's over 200 years old and worth more than 18,000, they need to provide evidence that it was legally acquired before it came into the
okay.
EU. So that's the aim. So it might and likely will. People might stop buying stuff outside of the EU to avoid the red tape, is what these gallery and auctioneering people are saying. However, I think they've had a lot of notice on this.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think this is just another one of those things that hopefully will deter tax evasion and money laundering. So it's got a good rationale behind it. And hopefully the digital portal is straightforward. But I think there'll be no avoiding it.
Okay.
Anyway.
Anybody watching the rugby, it's now 14-7 to the Lions, just coming in there. So you might want to have another look at that. Stephen, what about the profits in the Gresham Hotel? 6.7 million, that's a decent year's work.
It is, especially when you take it in context, 46% up year on year. And it's reflective of what John Mulligan calls the buoyant market in the capital. I mean, a massively underserved market in the capital.
Nearly 7 million on turnover of 27 million.
I mean, it is incredible. Now, I think it is important to note too that the operator here, Ruby Hotels and Resorts, they acquired the Gresham in 2016 for 92 million. And they have invested heavily in it during those years. So they've kind of put the money in. Now they're seeing the rewards. But the owners of the hotel firm last year said that the book value of the land and building was 54.5 million.
So they've taken a capital hit of nearly 50 million.
Yes. And it's important to know this is a long-term investment. But this is the type of return you want. I mean, we want more accommodation available in Dublin for tourists. We want a buoyant tourist industry. So we need our hotels that are operating here to be successful.
Caroline, Paul Coulson facing last down about it. This is a fairly complicated story, but at a high level.
Yeah, at a high level, I suppose.
Yeah.
Look, this is a multi-billion euro packaging giant. They specialise, obviously, glass, cans and packaging. And the glass part of the business is struggling at the moment due to inflation, interest rates, consumer demand changing. But this company has done exceptionally well, as has Paul Coulson, who is a 73-year-old who owns 36% of the business. So now, basically, ultimately, as part of this restructuring, they need to reduce their liabilities. And I suppose they've been trying to avoid this for quite a while in terms of restructuring and, you know, other managing of debt. And now the time has come that they basically need to do it. But ultimately, I think everybody has done well out of this business along the way, it seems.
So, well, there's a lot of people going to have to be taking a lot of pain here.
Absolutely, yeah.
On the $12.5 billion debt.
Yeah, 10 billion is a lot of money to try.
And you're looking at basically the bondholders being offered the business in lieu of this debt, Stephen. It's the numbers are huge.
They are. I mean, the write-off here could be as much as 2.32 billion. Now, you get full ownership of the glass containers part of the business. The challenge here is you've got different parts of the business that are doing far better than others.
Yeah.
Joe Brennan wrote this piece in the Times, and in a way, it's a shame that his last line wasn't used as the headline. He says, bondholders thinking they can wave off Coulson and a number of legacy investors in Ardagh Group with a $250 million check had better have the bottle for a battle. I think it's a gem of a line, and it kind of does underpin here that this is going to be complicated and certainly not kind of a quick fix.
Caroline, I don't know if you've seen U2 play in Croke Park, but But there's a nice kind of nostalgia piece by Darren McManus in today's Independent. Again, I've seen them there a couple of times.
Yeah.
They were the first Irish band to play in Croke Park, which I think is history in itself. I think Neil Diamond might have played the year before, but he ain't Irish, as we know.
No, absolutely. And you can see how Darren McManus absolutely loved this, writing this article, because he has put in so much detail and nuance and has done a really good job. But yeah, an epic occasion in June 1985 when they played there. And I suppose since, obviously, there were 60,000 people there then. But since then, I suppose they've just so contributed to the rich and culture of Ireland in all of their things. But they call Croke Park their spiritual home. And this week, The Edge finally became an Irish citizen in Killarney.
Right.
Which was another milestone, and 40 years on from Live Aid doesn't seem like that long, but
which is next week, I think, or maybe the week after.
Yeah, yeah. Like, unbelievable. And this year we've got Robbie Williams, which I'm really looking forward to going to see in late August, and Oasis are also going to be there. So again, it's really come as a really significant music venue in Ireland with lots of really cool headline acts, and obviously a very good financial move back in 1984 for the GAA to open it to concerts and to other things, because they've done really well out.
No, yeah. I remember, Stephen, I think it was 1985, seeing, I was working in the CNE Stadium in Toronto, and seeing you two and being so proud that these guys were Irish and they were now on the big stage. But they really have made Croke Park their home from all those 40-odd years ago.
Yeah, they really have. And, you know, we encourage people to buy a paper when we do this segment. This piece by Darren McManus is well worth the price of the Irish Independent today. Go out, buy the paper, or pay the subscription online to read this. As Caroline said, the amount of research that's gone into this piece is incredible. And it's peppered with these really interesting anecdotes. Two stood out for me. One was the fact that you could buy a ticket for their 1991 gig in the RDS for £20. How quaint is that?
Seems like a long time ago.
But I also love, on a weekend where it's going to be obviously a massive one in Croke Park, that the U2 drummer Larry Mullen could have begun his career at a far earlier stage. He was in the Artane Boys band. He quit after 3 weeks when they demanded he cut his hair, and so he missed out on some gigs on the first and third Sundays in September, but things worked out okay for him.
Finally, Caroline, the Daily Cuppa does protect the heart. You just need to be careful how much sugar you put in your cup of tea.
Yeah, I love this as an avid cuppa drinker, but basically what this tells us is that there's been very good research done, which I'm delighted to hear about, by Nantong University in China, that basically says that we lower the risk of heart problems and stroke if we drink up to 2 cups of unsweetened tea. Now, I put loads of milk in my tea. It doesn't mention the milk, but I'm just going with the fact that the unsweetened cup basically preserves the biologically active compounds in the tea, which have an antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effect. So really recommending everyone to go make a cuppa straight after this, isn't it?
Well, I just prefer coffee, but there you go.
You're not one bit
tea,
biased.
Oscar Wilde described it as the only simple pleasure left, Stephen. was that an accurate description in your view?
Yeah, I'm a coffee person too, but maybe this is the secret to the Irish longevity.
All right, Stephen O'Leary and Caroline Reedy, thanks for a great business review.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.